authorized for town.
Liquor Commission, Oregon Liquor Control Commission. We have all of these people up here. We have a couple of people that are calling in and that for this, but we're glad that you're all here for the meeting. We do also have, I'd like to note that OLCC Commissioner Marvin Raval, who just came in, will be joining us here on the dais, unless you'd like to take at least a breather. But welcome very much. Welcome. Okay, we only have two things on our agenda. One deals with revenue stability and the system expansion, and the other one deals with some of the marijuana legalization. So we'll start out with the revenue stability and system expansion. And the one thing, of those of you that have not either called in or tuned in before on this, this is basically just information on the OLCC, information that we're having as legislators to be able to make decisions down the road. So this is not really a decision-making committee. It is just bringing information forth on the OLCC. Okay. Mark, Jody.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Steve Marks. I'm the director of OLCC. With me is Bill Schutte, our resident expert and economist. I just wanted to give you some context for what you're going to be hearing today. We're going to talk about system expansion, which is not a decision, but which are options and ways we could expand the system, different paces of change to expand the system, different tools and processes that we'd use to accomplish that should a choice be made to move in that direction for both customer convenience and to meet future demand. We will also detail for you and outline the business case to increase our shipping capacity and our request in our budget, as well as online licensing. And then recap, it's at Chair Byers' request, recap some of the policy ideas that came out of the CRAFT conference that we had in Bend. So that we can see, you know, what kinds of actions you may or may not want to take on those and what actions could be taken at the administrative level. And then lastly, to address the pending passage of the marijuana ballot measure and sort of our initial scope on activities and plans surrounding that. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bill.
For the record, Bill Schutte, economist with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. This is kind of an extension, as pointed out, Madam Chair, that the education process will be looking at the retail system, but more closely looking at the number of stores in the state, how that compares with the national averages, averages for control stores, some of our partnerships that we've been started with the industry to look at potential expansion, not necessarily more outlets, but other ways as well. And I guess system expansion, first slide probably is a question mark, because there are probably some that believe the system is just fine the way it is. But coming out of legislative task force and at last go around, one thing they all agreed upon, even the grocers, was the need for more outlets potentially. So going that, we'll go right into it. Oregon liquor stores right now, we have currently about 250 approved locations in the state of Oregon, 61 stores in the Portland metro area, and I'll be talking a lot about the Portland metro area as far as potential areas for expansion, both either number of outlets or store size or other marketing efforts. In the Portland metro area, because we have these neat little new GIS tools, we were able to calculate that it's an average between 61 stores of 2.1 miles driving distance from each other, an average of 1.7 miles of linear distance from each other. And again, consumer sales, reiteration of previous presentations, statewide, average store has about 1.5 million, and the Portland metro area has almost twice that much at 2.7 million. And again, the Portland Metro stores and kind of the model of store location, I think the term was used one time, it's called the franchise model. These are the stores in the Portland area with 1 mile circles driven around them. And the underlying layer is the population density. So they are located in areas of high population, but they are located apart from each other. So a little bit about liquor store history for the state. The number of liquor stores have data going back to 1970. Currently, we're at about the 250 store level. So you can see the number of stores climbing from about 170 in 1970. The arrow is pointing to when the last state-run store was converted to a contract. And so after 1982, 83, somewhere in there, all the there's all contract stores. And so the total number of stores per state. If we do a ratio analysis looking at the population per liquor store, we see back in the 70s, it was pretty evenly about 12,000 Oregonians per store. And then after the state-run liquor store, it started to climb, and we're at about a level of about 16,000 Oregonians total per liquor store. So how does Oregon compare to the rest of the nation? So as I said, the Oregon average is about one store per 16,000 total population. The national average, which is, again, a combination of 51 different liquor regulatory systems, is one store per about 4,500. The high on that end, to give you an idea of the range, is Kentucky of one store per 1,000 almost, and the low is Georgia at one store per 27,000. Just an idea of our neighbors, California, one store per 2,800 population, and Washington after privatization is now at about one store per 5,000. For reference, because Oregon is a control state, the control state average is one store per 8,500 about. So we are higher than the control state average.
Can I ask you a question on this one?
Yes.
With the variance in how many stores service how many people, is there any information as to what the income of these stores are and whether they are combined with groceries or whether they're just straight liquor stores?
Yes. Yes, there is that information, and I guess, you know, we can put that together for you. Or,
well, it was just curious. I mean, if you've got one liquor store or agency for every 1,000 people in mm-hmm. Kentucky, either you're not making any money or everyone's going to the liquor store.
Right. Yeah, so I don't have that level of detail. So
thank you.
States. Let me see. Yeah. So if there is an interest in expansion of liquor sales with the state or expansion of liquor store outlets, how would we do that potentially? And there's a couple of ways that this would happen. And again, this is partnering with industry. They've helped us with some of the market analysis that we've been lacking over the last couple of years, looking at areas that are potentially underserved, looking at opportunities to better manage shelf management in existing stores, better product management that are better matched to the demographics of the area itself. There's been a number of stores that have relocated and increased their store size. And one thing interesting in Oregon, spirits is about 32% of the alcohol market, which is slightly under the national average, the other percentages being beer and wine. So with our industry partners, we've come up with some demographic market information that could potentially be used to locate new liquor stores versus the circle model or circle analysis that we've kind of relied on in the past. Those demographics include the total population, number of households per zip code, average household income, and population of 21 to 34-year-olds. As I think in my first presentation on forecasting, that segment of the population, not just Oregon, but the rest of the country, is a key driver of spirit sales. Mm-hmm. We could also look at opportunities for cross-border sales. State of Idaho, for example, after the Washington transition, has constructed one new store, and I think they're thinking about another one. And then, of course, we could look at the existing store system to maximize store performance. Are the stores there doing what they could be doing, given the demographics of that area, the preferences of that area, and other factors? So some of, using, again, our industry analysis, came up with some expansion opportunities based on several of the factors which I just discussed, and here in order is some of the areas that they would recommend expansion in based on market opportunities. And of course, most of them are located within the Portland metro area, but we do have Lane County in there, Benton County, Marion County. So the most heavily populated areas are the areas that the industry sees as, you know, potential areas of future growth. And then beyond that, say, okay, we say Clackamas County or Multnomah County, can we drill down more into that and come up with some other ways of where to locate a new store or expand stores if that's a desire? And the Portland metro area, one way to do it is through zip code analysis. That's just a segment that they can partition off and look at various characteristics within that area. In the Portland metro area, there are 61 stores, but 71 zip codes. Each zip code has an average of about 1,700 households per square mile. Drilling down into possible locations, 28 zip codes in the Portland metro area do not have a store. And there are five zip codes that are above the 1,700 households per square mile that do not have a liquor store. So there are areas that may be underserved in the Portland metro area. So looking at ways that we could look at expanding the market and some of the tools, but I want to give you some measure metrics. These are just ways that different ways of looking at the density and the number of stores. Current market for spirits is about $520 million in gross sales with about a 4.5% annual growth, 7.1 million gallons, 31 million bottles, 3 million cases. So a question, if we do want to expand, how much? And this really, unfortunately, isn't an economics question. It's probably more of a policy question, but I can give you 50 different ways to look at it anyway. But probably not the way. So if we're looking at just relating it to population, for example, Oregon's forecast population growth is about 50,000 annual growth over the next 5 or 8 years. Using the current ratio, that would mean adding potentially three stores per year to maintain the current ratio of population to stores. Looking at it just from a revenue standpoint, looking at about an average of $28 million per year, with the average $2 million sales per store, we could potentially add 14 stores per year and still maintain the current status quo. If we wanted to, for example, get back to the 1980s, where it was one store per 12,000, again, this is just some of the basic math, we'd potentially could go up to 325 stores or 75 added stores. And to get at the control state average of one store and about 8,000, we'd have to add another 223 stores. So these aren't proposals, but just ways to look at it and say, okay, what is a methodology we could use to justify or validate expansion of the system. So these are some of the tools and opportunities for creating the conditions to expand. We will and continue to work with agents to maximize the revenues at existing store. This includes training for agents and staff, store remodels, location, looking at hours of operation, the return on investment of their store, evaluation of the underserved areas, that zip code analysis that I referred to. Perhaps there are some areas in the Portland metro area that, and other areas outside of Portland metro that could be evaluated for new stores. And then, again, support of the non-traditional retail opportunities. You heard about store within a store. The exclusive store conversion, where we have a store that's just a liquor store to exclusive store where they can sell other things, which may include beer and wine along with spirits, mall seasonal locations, distillery tasting rooms, allowing sales out of those, and perhaps online ordering. And so quickly, the tools that we're looking at for expansion of the system. We do want to work with the agents closely for system governance and agents as being a partner of the expansion, looking at differentiating between the different needs and characteristics of rural versus urban stores, always looking at the contracts, the type, the length, the service requirements, and the return on investment to the agents and to the state. Agents' compensation, big topic, which will always be talked about. Working with the industry for analytics, which we started to do in a more robust nature, looking at some potential areas for expansion and perhaps in using industry to aid our agents and some of their shelf management. And then establish, at the same time, expansion, we need to still establish and monitor the health and safety benchmarks because we don't know how much is too much. until probably it actually happens. And so being able to say, well, what are the incidents of DUIs? What are the incidents of consumption? That sort of thing. And then related to that, if any expansion of the system, which we'll get into my next presentation, would be increasing the warehouse shipping capacity. So with that, I'll close for any questions or comments.
Okay. Are there any questions, Senator?
As you know, we passed the legalization of marijuana, which the OLCEC is supposed to regulate. I would assume it would go through the liquor stores, but maybe we'll set up something totally independent. That data wasn't included in these assumptions, was it?
No, it's not. There'll be more discussion on the talk of the marijuana and how that system will affect the liquor system, but it's right now we're probably looking at it as almost an agency with an agency as far as how we set up that type of work. But in these assumptions, no, it hasn't been included with that.
Okay. Any other questions? I did one thing I was just going to say. Senator Beyer is just getting off a plane and will be a few minutes late. But anyway, we just finished the presentation. Any other questions or comments or anything you'd like to have input? The one question I have, and what this was a presentation from our esteemed economist on just kind of assumptions that you can do for either expansion of liquor stores and so on. And one of the things that didn't seem to be up on one of the scenarios is, I mean, how many people would more stores, again, be able to make money? I mean, do we have so many people that drink that we need 223 more liquor stores?
And I guess in my mind that gets to the question of policy. But from the retail end, for the industry and the grocery and everyone else, they're seeing a need for more outlets. And then Oregon being on the lower end of the national average, both not just nationally but control states, there is that impetus to try to, increase that number if we can. But it doesn't mean more outlets. Doesn't mean more expansion of the existing stores. I guess that's nothing that I guess we can't answer from an economic standpoint.
So we don't. I mean, is there any way to even come up with an idea that X percent of Oregonians drink distilled spirits?
Yes.
Can we do that?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I don't have the number with me, but we have those numbers.
Because to me, it's just kind of an economies of scale. You know,
right.
Saying, you know, if we take the national average of this, then we need these many stores, but are they going to be able to make it financially because of demand? So, anyway. Senator Beyer, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I missed the presentation, but catching the question, I just have to ask. You know, I just got off a plane from L.A., and every time I'm down there, I'm just always amazed, you know, because we have this discussion about how much demand is there, and if we added any more, we would just put everybody out of business. Yet when I'm there, it looks like about on every other corner, there is a liquor store that by all visible observation looks to be thriving, as well as all of the grocery stores also have liquor outlets. So I have a hard time balancing that in my head in terms of that. It seems like that if you have more outlets, people seem to buy more.
And Senator Beyer, in response to that, there is some research that indicates that the number of higher number of outlets, greater the consumption, but that is not, universal across all states. And there are states like California where the consumption and is equal or less than Oregon right now. So it's it has also to do with outlets, but demographic makeup, religious preferences. If you go to Utah, you have a very low consumption rate for obvious reasons. So.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Are you going to stay with us? Or
stay with you for one more round here.
Okay, thank you.
This gets into what Director Marks, again, Bill Schutte, economist for the Liquor Control Commission, into kind of what we're seeing is some of the more immediate needs for the future is to sustaining the liquor system we have and what we need to get to meeting demand for whether the system expands or not, just meeting the demand for new spirits sales. So first, the policy option package 4, which is in our agency requested budget, is to increase the OLCC warehouse shipping capacity. I think most of you have been through the warehouse and kind of have a feel for what it looks like and some of the challenges that may be faced there. And I want to just go through the kind of the business case for this policy option package. We do have physical hard copies or copies of that business case that we gave to DAS and LFO's office for their analysis. So the problem with the current warehouse system we have is that we believe that the OLCC warehouse has reached a maximum shipping capacity, and that's about 3 million cases per year. We're probably going to hit 3 million cases this year. Last year it was about 2.95. We're shipping an average of 12.2 hours per day, with employing about 47.5 FTE on two different shifts, a day shift and a swing shift. So the issue we're running into from our capacity standpoint is that all shipping goes through a single single conveyor out one door. And in our economic analysis, if that limitation truly is 3 million cases per year, which we believe it is, then that in the 15-17 biennium and well beyond, at least in the 15-17 biennium, could put up to $75 million of liquor sales at risk. That doesn't necessarily mean we will categorically lose those liquor sales, but it could be a risk means delayed shipments, out of stock, and maybe some lost sales. It's too hard to quantify, but if we don't meet the demand, you know, and a consumer comes in the store to pick up a bottle of whatever and it's not there, then will they come back to that store? So over the 10-year period, we're looking at about a $1.1 billion gross liquor sales at risk if we don't do something to expand the shipping capacity of the warehouse. And again, this is very familiar to you. You see the backup on the lower photo. You see everything coming down, going out through one door, and all the cases backed up. We're proposing for investment will be able to have the ability to at least ship out multiple doors. So the solution, option A, is a capital expenditure of $5.02 million to add a conveyor system with automated sortation software. Sortation software, as you can see in the photo there, allows you to load multiple orders at the same time and then automatically sorts those into different conveyor belts that eventually will go out to different trucks. So instead of loading one truck at the time, we can load maybe up to five trucks at the same time. Looking at some benchmarks of other warehouses in the Portland area, we believe this increases the shipping capacity by 140% with no increase in FTE. If this option is not granted, we were looking for option B, which would add 14 FTE to the swing shift for an approximate annual biennium cost of $1.8 million and ongoing cost of about $1.6 million per biennium. However, we're feeling that this will eventually get to some physical limitations that will not avoid the need for an option A type investment. We're just simply running out of capacity to get product out the door. And so, again, going back in time, this to me demonstrated, or the best way to demonstrate our productivity constraint, going back to 1990, this is a graph of FTE and the number of cases handled per FTE. FTE is a blended rate between permanent and temporary, and so we were able to do this calculation and find that back in the 90s, average product worker could handle about 50,000 cases. That's receiving, storing, and shipping. As that started to climb into about 2003, 2004, we faced a similar type of constraint, and so additional FTE were added. At least on three different occasions, to get it back below that 60,000 mark, which we believe is a maximum mark for the amount of capacity under our current system. But as of fiscal year 2014, we are back over that 60,000 case per FTE threshold and starting to realize some issues in fulfilling orders and increased overtime and, again, coming back to look for a more permanent solution to this choke point issue. The physical capacity limitations that we're faced with is trucks need to be loaded by 8 p.m. to ensure next day delivery to the destinations outside of the metro Portland area. I mentioned our average shipping window is 12.2 hours, working 5 days a week. Comparable operation with this type of option A investment is probably closer to 8 or 10 hours a day, at least the one we visited, and they're able to get much more product out the door. In fact, probably 3 or 4 times more product out the door with the option A sortation system that we're looking at. We're also running into workspace limitations, personal safety. You've been in the warehouse, a lot of forklifts going around, and if we feel we get too many bodies on the floor, then that creates problems as well. And then logistics and IT constraints, overlapping issues of ordering, scheduling, and shipping occurring at the same time. So if we continue to push out the shipping window, that gets overlays with trucking issues and ordering issues, then all sorts of problems are starting to manifest themselves. And so what we see as a result of that is a 14-hour maximum shipping window if we get additional FTE. However, that still won't avoid a option A type investment somewhere down the road. So the financial evaluation, this comes out of
Bill,
part of
have
the
a question.
Yes.
Before we go on, with option A, it was unclear to me what you were saying. If we were to fund the improvement in the inventory system, mm-hmm. Does that require changes to the capital, to a capital expenditure, new loading docks, that sort of thing?
It will require capital expenditure to the conveyor system. It may require some expenditures to the loading docks, but we have the doors already.
All of that's included in the number?
Okay. Yeah.
And does that speak to the workspace limitations issue if we do the option A?
Option A has no increase in FTE. In fact, we feel it may even improve some of the workspace limitations because the workers won't have to move around as much. They'll be able to stay at a single location, pick those cases, fulfill multiple orders from that location rather than jumping around.
And let me think about it. The 14-hour maximum shipping window, talk a little bit more about that. Why couldn't you add a graveyard shift?
That is option B, is to add that graveyard shift. But even with a graveyard shift, that the trucks have to be loaded by a certain time to be able to make it over the mountains into regions outside of the Portland area. There are issues, of course, with ordering on the system. You're trying to ship and order and reconcile, schedule shipping for the next day. It is just, the maximum that we think we can handle with the current people.
Can't you adjust some of that with scheduling, like do your across the mountains stuff first and your this side of the mountains later?
There are some opportunities for scheduling there, but I think our warehouse staff has adjusted some of those opportunities on a minor basis. We know we have to load the Portland stores first thing in the morning for same-day delivery, and then the over-the-mountain stores or outside of the Portland metro area stores after, I think, 2 o'clock. So there are opportunities for scheduling, but we're at a point where the choke point is becoming so constrained that we feel we have to do something either technology-wise or FTE-wise to be able to address that.
So why is the same day, next day, kind of a just-time delivery system, why is that really important?
Well, the ordering system is to keep the liquor stores in product. As you might know, the liquor stores don't have a lot of storage facility. So we essentially warehouse for the liquor stores, and we are able to get them. They order on a frequent basis. Some is one times a week, sometimes it's twice a week. There are some stores that order 3 times a week just to keep themselves in stock, so they can meet the demand out there. They don't have the storage facilities in the back of their current facilities to accommodate increased inventory.
And when you looked at that inventory system, seems like I remember early on we talked about you had some consultants in, warehousing consultants in terms of dealing with that.
Yes.
And this is based on recommendations.
Yes, this is based on our recommendations.
Thank you.
Well, some of this stuff with with a graveyard shift, is it also logistics on the other end that possibly a store owner would have to be at their store at 4 in the
right.
morning
and
to take delivery?
Yeah, and it really is. Thank you, Representative Doherty. It really is a combination of things, and that store owners have to be open to be able to accept shipments at a certain time. They would prefer to accept shipments not during the busiest time of the day. Mm-hmm. So there are all sorts of factors in here that contribute to this 14-hour maximum window.
I worked at grocery stores to get freight at night.
Yeah.
You know, after the store was closed.
Right.
So. Okay.
And again, it also gets to the requirements and needs of the trucking companies as well. So looking at it from a financial standpoint, I was pointed out by a few that many don't know what a net present value analysis is, and I'll explain it. Basically, it's looking at all the cash flows into the future and discounting it to current dollars, so the bigger number is better. So if we look at an option A, which is the conveyor upgrade with automated sortation over a 10-year time frame, which we believe this will keep us, address our capacity limitations in 10 years and well beyond that. In offsetting the revenue at risk, we're looking at $920 million net present value. With option B, which would add FTE and still have a choke point, but reoccurring labor costs as expanding the swing shift or the second shift, lower $600 million net present value over a 10-year time frame. But again, given the constraint on the physical limitations, we still would be looking at probably some sort of conveyor upgrade investments by fiscal year 2018. And so I looked at it both, what if you did the labor up front and then installed the conveyor with the automated sortation system, so a combination of option A and option B has a lower net present value, so basically you're still spending $1.6 or $2 million and then have to face inevitability of the $5.01 million investment anyway. And this business case, as I said, is available for...
So is your assumption that you'd amortize this over 10 years?
Yes.
Okay. So I assume it'd be debt financed.
Yeah. Another part of the evaluation for option A is the payback period. We believe that 2 months after the completion that we'll be offsetting revenue at risk at this time. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward analysis that, we'll 20 to 30 million per month at some point that we can offset just by the system. Resale value, because it is a question of, privatization hanging over the state, is, if we were to invest in a system, how much would we get out of it? And I guess it would depend on how the buyer will use the current facility. Any buyer that uses the facility for beverage shipping would assign a higher value to it, but the new conveyors could be resold for an estimated 35% of the current value. So there is value in the system after the investment. So the conclusion that OLCC is recommending is the option A, the expanded conveyor system. It has a higher present value, and both, I showed you the 10-year investment frame, but we also did a 4-year investment frame for mitigating gross liquor sales at risk. Adding FTE had a lower return on investment, making option A the best short and long-term solution. The consequences of no investment is failure to provide any investment, both short and long-term revenues at risk. And then failure to modernize the OLCC warehouse puts pressure on multiple industries, not just the state of Oregon's revenue source, but our industry partners that support the system as well.
Any questions before we go on to the roof?
Then we go on to the roof.
So again, what did you say the potential loss of revenue from not doing something was?
$78 million. $78 million.
In the next biennium,
yes. We are at our choke point right now.
It looks like your cash flow, assuming a 10-year investment, you're probably looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of $300,000 a year payment.
Yeah, or I don't know how the payments would be done or up front or if they're just going to be taken directly out of liquor funds.
Traditional, if you're bonding it over 10 years, it's probably looking somewhere in that neighborhood. 300 against 78 million. Not a bad investment.
Even I can do the math on that.
At one point, I was asked to calculate return on investment, and it's just in the thousands of percent. So, again, this is one of the investments that we're looking at.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, under the roof.
So another one of our big issues, of course, as you know, is the roof, POP 301, roof repairs estimated, and we have an engineer's analysis of this as well, $4.2 million. We have two warehouses, the one in McLaughlin, where our main office is, and the Millport warehouse, which is about a mile or so up the street.
The square footage on those?
We'll get to the square footage of those. So half of the McLaughlin warehouse and about 100, almost 100% all of the Millport warehouse. $80 million in retail inventory at risk, $70 million in vendor-owned inventory. So it's pretty obvious that we have to keep a roof over the product, even though we don't own a lot of it. It's still very valuable to the state and industry partners.
What's our liability on the vendor? So, is it covered by our insurance?
I believe it is, yes. I don't know the answer to that, but I can find out. Yeah. We do work with DAS or risk management, so it is insured.
How bad a shape are the roofs in?
They're in a shape where, well, let's go on to the next one. So here we have the McLaughlin warehouse, which is 124,000 square feet, and Millport about 105,000.
Wow.
Buildings, the age of the roof is 1977. So... there are parts that are failing as we speak right now. Now, this isn't to say there's been no maintenance done on these roofs. They've been continually maintained, but we're a point of patches over patches. So average roof age of 37 years. Some of the stuff you've already seen, the photo on the left, again, leaks in a warehouse, very common during rain events. What we have to do with these is move product around a lot, so it's not just a product issue, but it's a labor issue as well. The middle shows a little workaround that they catches the water, and there's a hose coming down into a bucket or a pail there to try to keep it away from the product. And then the photo on the right shows some stuff. They're trying to divert the water away, and you can see the water coming in. So that was pretty much it. I mean, it's a roof. It's housing a lot of warehouse. It needs to be fixed.
Is the agency the owner of the warehouses?
The agency is the owner of the warehouse,
well,
yes.
Okay,
yes.
So it's an exception.
Okay, any questions? Senator Gerard.
Well, what type of roof do you propose to replace it with? What materials?
I don't have the representative, Senator Gerard, I don't have the engineer's report in front of me, but I can get you that information.
Yes, sir. There's a little doubt if it's a 37-year-old roof.
It's a 37-year-old
probably
roof.
Leaking.
No, I don't know. Yeah. I'm just, if you're going to replace it, you know, metal roofs are pretty sweet.
Yeah. Maybe if you get that information to the committee, we'd appreciate that.
Okay. As opposed
okay.
to.
Okay. Any other questions?
I guess just yeah. one. What was the assumption on the re-roofing? Was it a membrane roof?
I think it depends. I think one is a membrane roof and the other one isn't. But, again, I'd have to consult with the engineering report.
I'm surprised you have one, a membrane roof if it's 37 years old. It just sounds like hot tar.
Yeah. I'm not the roofing expert. I have access to the information. But
you don't have that as a sideline to an economist?
We can share with you that has everything that you know about the roof. And, you know, the skylights and everything that needs to be...
We have
that.
No roofing scenarios here.
Yeah, no roofing scenarios. It's either we get it or we don't get it. So,
okay. Fine. Thank you very much. Anything else? Thank you for the information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Mr. Marks, are you going to join us up here? And then also Mr. Hall.
Madam Chair, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. I just wanted, I missed one beat here last time. Chairman Patridge is... apologetic for not being able to be here today at some criminal incidents in Klamath County, and I failed to let you know that before, but otherwise he would be here. He was intending to make it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mark.
Okay, thank you.
Another murder.
Okay.
Out there.
I know.
Co-chairs, committee members, my name is Mark Hall. For the record, I'm the IT director at the Liquor Control Commission. So I'm going to be talking with you today about a policy option package that we've put forward to take our service permitting and licensing application process online. And right out of the gate, the business drivers, why we want to do this, of course, because we see substantial growth in our licensing and permitting operations. Just for a little background, in 2015, our projected number of license events, if you will, that we have to process is approximately 15,500. By 2020, we see that at about 18,500. And in service permits in 2015, we estimate approximately 42,000 service permits that we'll process. That will grow to approximately 53,500 by 2020, by our estimates. And of course, there's always the clear need in this day and age, of course, that we modernize and put this online in the first place, right? Everybody has an iPhone or an iPad. Everybody has a web browser. It's kind of par for the course that people are going to want to do this online. We also see an opportunity through hosting this information on the web to improve our intergovernmental data sharing as well, though. So OLCC obviously doesn't operate in a vacuum. We share information as part of our licensing process with, for instance, law. And so we would hope to be able to actually make this sort of information available to our sister agencies in an electronic format more efficiently than we do today. So the project objectives would be, of course, to improve customer service. That one, again, seems clear. If you can put your application in online anywhere, anytime, versus, you know, hey, I got to go put this in the mail, or I'm going to go jump in the car, grab my checkbook, if you will, go down to the local OLCC office. It also improves information availability for our staff as well, though. So we do see some streamlining of our regulatory process by having this information captured electronically and available electronically to OLCC staff. So, of course, the implementation, again, very straightforward. We would be accepting liquor licenses and service permits online, and we would allow applicants to, in essence, swipe their card online using the state's e-government system. And what we propose to do is to integrate this with our existing back-end license and service permit processing systems. So we're not looking at a full system replacement per se. We're really looking at just a small targeted enhancement of the system to collect it online, but to automatically insert that information into our existing back-end systems. So the fact that all of this information would be captured and made available to OLCC staff electronically alleviates one of the main challenges that we face today with our existing systems. We do have a license system and a service permit system, so we can process an application through to issuing the certificate of license, of course. But the current systems don't capture all the information that comes in on an application packet. So often that has to be reviewed actually on paper. Part of what we're proposing, of course, is now that that's electronic, that's available to our investigative staff right on the computer through a web browser. So every application that would come in online then is also an application that we don't have to manually input into those back-end systems. So even though they don't capture all the information today, we still do have to capture a certain subset of that information in order to process the application. And so every time that somebody would go online, that's less manual input that somebody at the OLCC has to perform. And, of course, our customers, we anticipate, would experience an increase in service quality and convenience. Again, we're kind of – the way I've looked at this anyway is, you know, do I have to go find my checkbook is kind of the first thing. I mean, if we're not today we don't accept credit cards for these transactions.
So I have a question. So if I'm going for a server's license, I have to go someplace to actually give you the information? That's not online? Because, I mean, there are thousands and thousands of servers.
Not necessarily. You can also do this through the mail.
Okay.
And then I think that sometimes actually piggybacks. Sometimes I think the licensee actually takes responsibility for helping servers get their service permits as well. So the design of the system that we're looking at, one of the primary design goals is flexibility. So when we've looked at this problem, of course, the only thing that's constant in the universe is change, right? So we're looking at a very flexible system designed around the concept that we know that there will be changes in rule and law, et cetera, and so we need to have the flexibility to respond quickly to get those changes online, say, if the information we have to capture on an application changes. Again, our approach here is a very small-scale enhancement to existing systems. Laser focus. We want to do one thing and do it well. We want to put these online, a very thin system, just to collect it, just to process the e-commerce payment, and then move that into our existing systems for processing. And so we're viewing this as a small development contract, really just an augmentation to OLCC staff. It's a low cost, small in scope, minimal complexity, and we see it as a low risk option to move to online. And again, we're looking at very modern technologies and design. We're looking at some of the latest technologies in web development that allow for the sorts of flexibility that I'm talking about. So the total policy option package that we're asking for is $250,000. And the total estimated development cost, which includes our estimates for OLCC staff time, totals $516,000. We anticipate a 5-year benefit of $1.35 million, the net benefit of $158,000, with a payback period of 4.5 years and an ROI of 13%. Any questions?
Any questions?
Yeah.
Yes. Senator Beyer.
So now we're talking about not the inventory side, the liquors. We're talking about just the licensing here?
That's correct.
And is this one been proposed as part of the portal project through DAS?
No, this is not proposed as part of the portal project through DAS.
Hmm. Why not?
Well, again, we viewed this as being a very small-scale, very thin project, and really built around very specific requirements that OLCC has. So one of the things to kind of keep in mind about OLCC is that our application process probably looks a little more like TurboTax in some ways than the normal application process. So I don't want to get overly technical, but one of the things that we will have to do is actually calculate the packet, in essence, that we would be presenting to the applicant. And so we'll actually have to go through, if you will, sort of an interview or a survey portion of the website first. That's kind of the TurboTax, analog that I use.
So has this been reviewed by the CIO's office?
It has. There's a business case analysis that I believe is either included in your packet or that should be available to you, and that did go through the CIO's office.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad it's not going through DAS. DAS and high-tech projects don't always go together very well. But the question I have is, the state of Oregon, with anything to do with computers, you're going to need a large fudge factor in there because it always runs more than what we think it is. This seems to be fairly low, and $250,000 seems to be a fairly low amount. I mean, what's our risk on the other end? Cover Oregon is the one example of how bad it can get, and then we have smaller projects like this. I'm just curious if you have a fudge factor into your $250,000.
Well, Senator Gerard, if you want to give me $100 million, I'll give you one heck of a website, right? But the $250,000...
I'm not sure. We didn't get much for $270 million.
Actually, it does include a small contingency budget. Again, this was working in conjunction with the CIO's office. But again, the approach we're really looking at here is an augmentation of internal staff. So we have we do have expertise on staff to do some of this on our own steam. But there are certain aspects of the project that we feel we can use some outside expertise and some additional resources. A good example of that would be we're really looking to make this available through iPhone, iPad. We really want this to be modern. We really want it to be a good customer service experience. And so those are the sorts of expertise that we can augment in and, frankly, help train my staff up in some of those sorts of technologies as well as getting the additional contractor time. But
can I follow up on that?
Please.
I would think that the grocers, the United Grocers or Safeway, they all have the little pads. Seems to me like their programs that they already have in use could be easily adapted. But again, I'm not sure of that, but it just seems that way.
That's something I guess that we would have to look at. So this is really geared around OLCC's specific license requirements as laid out in statute and rule. So I'm not sure to what degree we would have a fit with any existing grocers programs. I'd have to do more research, I guess, there.
You're thinking like I was on the inventory side, I think.
Yeah.
Because what I'm looking at is I work in a restaurant, a nonprofit. We make profit, but a restaurant for the Kerr Centers. And you have to have a server's license,
right?
Because the wait staff who are all volunteers, serve liquor. And we have probably 140 wait staff that have to have service permits. And I know when I get a food handler's card, I can do it online. I can do all of this through the restaurant associations, right, very much. But the servers have to go through an entirely different process. And so I'm just thinking of this one area that has 140 servers. And it's a little easier when you're in a restaurant, a for-profit restaurant situation. But it's still one of those things. I mean, I can see. I didn't realize that you couldn't do this online anyway.
Yeah, no, we're not online yet with that.
And I've had a server's permit before, and it's just, you know, you take the test, and we used to take, have to go down and take the test, and then they'd give you your server's card.
Yeah, you'd have to use your number two pencil, yeah, right?
The server, yeah. Yes, we did. And the servers, and now the food handler's card, we do it all online. So I was kind of surprised when this came up, because I just thought you guys already had it. It's very like 19th century.
So like I said, we're the hope is to be able to modernize
this. Madam Chair, for the record, this is Marvin Revolve, I'm Commissioner. One of the biggest questions that I'm often asked in the community is, why do we still have to do everything by paper? No matter what it is, your organization, then it becomes my organization, your organization can't do anything modernized. And what we're trying to do is just that, mm-hmm, have more customer interaction, a better customer experience.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Okay, so Ms. Niedermeyer, are you next with the legislative concepts to support Oregon craft beverage industry?
And Jesse Sweet.
And also Jesse Sweet.
Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Beyer and Representative Doherty. For the record, my name is Renee Niedermeyer. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Communications for the OLCC. As you recall, in September, we had a joint meeting between this task force and the OLCC to talk about the economics of Oregon craft beverage industries. We invited the industry founders to talk about how they got started and the unique conditions in Oregon that helped them grow. We had the state economists, we had OSU, we had the Department of Ag, who talked about the importance of Oregon's craft beverage industries to the state economy. We had Travel Oregon and the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association come and talk about the positive impacts of the craft beverage industries on on tourism and local economies, particularly also including rural Oregon. The last panel consisted of presentations from the Oregon craft boards. We had the Oregon Wine Board, the Oregon Brewers Guild, the Oregon Distillers Guild, and the Northwest Cider Board. We asked the craft boards to describe themselves and to talk about the actions which, in their opinion, could help their industries grow. At the request of Serena Beyer, we've summarized those requests in this presentation. And you'll notice that not all of the actions, in fact, many of the actions don't require legislation. They most require the OLCC to work with the industry to make the changes and find ways to make progress. Steve Thompson from King Estate spoke on behalf of the Oregon Wine Board. He had a variety of requests. None of them required legislation. The first was a limited exception to the drinking on duty rule for winemakers. This requires a rule change, and it allows the wineries to sample wine when in service to patrons. So the OLC staff has made a commitment to work with the wineries and look at how we can make a limited exception to this rule. They also asked for more guidance and dialogue regarding minor decoy operations at wineries. We've also committed to doing some more training and outreach to the wineries so they understand what the rules are around minors, service to minors. The third thing they asked for is streamlining the privileged tax process. That's it's a fairly complicated process. It includes both state and federal tax law. So what we, our best opportunity there is to work with them to develop an online tax reporting system, and we're systematically making progress towards that. And the fourth thing is to add the Oregon Wine Board's annual production survey as part of the requirement for filing requirement for licenses. That ran into some legal and some administrative issues. However, what we have done is worked with the Oregon Wine Board, and we're looking to put their survey on the OLCC's website, and when we send the tax letter out to the wineries, adding that link to the tax letter.
So it sounds like, with respect to the wineries, you've got one rule change, and the other thing you can do just administratively?
Yes. And we're working on all of those.
And the folks that talk to us from the wineries, do they agree with that?
I believe so.
Okay.
Brian Petention from the Oregon Brewers Guild suggested changes to allow brewers similar privileges wineries. He didn't give specifics at the task force, but as staff has worked with the brewers, Brewery Public House, the brew pubs, we've noticed that there are a couple of statutory changes that could help them reach some of their goals. Two of those were, one was to hold an off-premises license in order to allow to-go sales at multiple licenses. Right now, a brew pub can sell by the drink, and it can sell to-go at up to two licenses, but if you get beyond that, then they need an off-premise license. So this allows them the ability to have that license and to sell to-go at multiple locations. The second item is to allow brew pubs a limited importation privilege, which allows them to import brands that they already own and bring them across state lines without having to go through the OLCC. And that also requires a change in statute. Ted Pappas from Big Bottom Whiskey, on behalf of the Oregon Distillers Guild, talked about two primary initiatives. Both require changes to statute. The first was to establish an Oregon Spirits Board similar to the Oregon Wine Board, and the purpose of the Spirits Board would be to promote the spirits industry in Oregon. The second was to allow distilleries to be able to collaborate by combining their tasting rooms and share expenses, and that would also take a statutory change. The third item on this slide came up at the task force itself, and Senator Canope was working with a constituent, and this allows Oregon distilleries to be able to purchase bulk grain spirits from an Oregon distillery. Currently, they can purchase it from an out-of-state or an out-of-country distillery, but not from an Oregon distillery. And it's just a little tweak in the statute. So obviously, a change in the statute would open the way for the Oregon distillers to use Oregon-crafted and grown products.
It's an unusual idea, isn't it?
Did you want to ask about whether they have or need a vehicle for any of
Pete the Mulligan from Bull Run Cider, Northwest Cider Board, proposed a number of concepts, specifically creating a separate cider license and statute, revise the definition of cider, and to apply a uniform cider-specific tax rate. Our intention is to have further discussions with the industry representatives to better understand what their objectives are and what some of the specifics behind these would be. There's some federal and state complications, so there's some things that we need to work out in order to synchronize with the federal laws as well. And in summary, I just wanted to say that the OLCC, the commissioners, the staff are committed to continuing working with the Oregon craft beverage industries to help them identify areas where we can do changes in rules, changes in procedures, or statutes to help them, those industries thrive.
Okay, thank you for the presentation. Senator Beyer.
Renee, there are a number of these you mentioned have needs for statutory change. Right. Is OLCC proposing legislation to deal with these?
We do not have legislation that we proposed. Our deadline was reached before we had our...
Okay, so you got the governor's restrictions.
I believe that there is some legislation. For instance, I believe the Oregon Distillers Board may be coming forth.
So is the commission generally supportive of these changes?
Yes, we are.
Thank you.
So, could we get these worked up into an OLCC modernization bill for consideration during the session?
It would be easy for your staff to work with the commission and anybody on any of those different craft areas to do that, Mr. Chair. At your direction, of course.
I think that was the intent when we met in Bend, was to do that, not committing that they'll all pass, but at least that would give us a vehicle for during the session.
Those might be tough bills to pass.
I'm just kidding. I think it's something under the relating cost of talk to relating to OLCC modernization.
We might change that relating clause a little.
I think that's a good one.
Perhaps.
Okay, any other questions?
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you.
Good presentation.
Are we done with liquor?
Madam Chair.
Because I was going to say, why don't we just take a 2 or 3 minute break? We don't want him more all the way down at the end, so we're going to move him up a little bit. So how about a 2 minute break, and we're on recess for 2 minutes. From the OLCC responsibilities with liquor to the OLCC to an explanation of the marijuana legalization with ballot measure 91.
Madam Chair, if I may, Director Steve Marks here with Jesse Sweet, who's a policy analyst for us, policy advisor. I just wanted to preface a little bit of this. It's what you know, but wanted to be clear. You know, the law doesn't go into effect till January. We do not have a staff yet that is working on this issue. We did spend time in anticipation of potential passage of the ballot measure to prepare for the eventuality that we would have to implement it. I'm very pleased to say that, you know, through interagency coordination, we were able to roll out on the website very factual information to provide the public and outlets for them to get information very quickly on this. Chairman Patridge actually was available in Portland to put a context around the deliberate process that the commission intends to have. But we haven't had even a discussion with our commission about this issue. So in that context, this is early, but we wanted to give you sort of our assessment of what the measure does, the responsibilities it gives us, and the seriousness with which we take responsibility given. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jesse.
Thank you. I'll be talking about the Control, Regulation, and Taxation of Marijuana and Industrial Hemp Act. The basics of this act are that it was ballot measure 91 approved by the voters on November 4th. The act is modeled...
Mr. Sweet, could you put your name on the record?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I am a policy analyst with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Ballot measure 91 was passed by the voters on November 4th. It is modeled after ORS Chapter 471, which is the Liquor Control Act. It creates a license model for the regulation of recreational marijuana for adults 21 and over, regulated very similar to the way that beer and wine are currently governed by the OLCC. It gives OLCC authority to tax, license, and regulate. The act also allows home grow of up to 4 plants and 8 ounces per residence. Yep. The act prohibits consumption in public, and it also allows localities to ban marijuana licenses from their jurisdiction through a general election and petition process. Some important dates in the measure. It is effective 30 days from passage, and it becomes operative on July 1st, 2015. This July 1st date is the date when the personal use and home grow provisions of the Act become operative. Also, the OLCC must adopt rules and accept license applications by January 4th, 2016.
And just with that, at that point, there's no retail outlets, just personal home consumption.
Yes, Co-Chair Doherty, on July 1st, 2015, all of the criminal provisions go into effect, but any sale production needs to happen with a license, which will come online sometime later. There are four license types: producer, processor, wholesale, and retailer. An individual may hold multiple licenses and multiple license types. In other words, there is no tied house prohibition as there is for liquor. An individual may sell at both wholesale and retail, and as many locations for which they're qualified. There is also no residency requirement for licensees, and the Act does not explicitly limit the location or number of licenses. Here's a little more detail on the license types. The producer is the only license which is able to grow or cultivate marijuana, and it's also the license that is responsible for the excise tax. The processor packages and labels marijuana items, also produces marijuana products such as edible products and marijuana concentrates. Wholesale and retail are what they sound like. Wholesale buys and sells at wholesale, and retail sells to adults over 21. The excise tax, as I mentioned, is paid by the producer, and that is paid at the first point of sale. The tax rate, which is indexed to inflation, is $35 an ounce for flowers, $10 an ounce for leaves, and $5 per immature plant. The Act does not affect the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. The Act also does not affect existing landlord-tenant law or existing employment law.
Are you going to explain that a little more? Can you explain that a little more?
It
does not affect landlord-tenant or employment law. So in other words, the current laws that we have under those two statutes remain the same.
Yes, current laws affecting employment, affecting housing, are all unchanged.
Got it. Okay, thank you. Senator Gratt.
Yeah, I tried to read the bill itself, and it's extremely complicated and very difficult to read. You have a statement, the Act does not affect the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. It's actually silent on that. Is that not correct?
Senator Girard, I believe this is specifically enumerated in Section 6 of the Act, which speaks to exemptions. Section 6, sub 2, B.
Well, my question is, could we... we're going to have two regulatory programs. Can we do away with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program if we're going to legalize marijuana? It only makes sense from an economic perspective to do this, and does the Act prohibit us from doing that?
Senator Girard, it's an excellent question, and I'm sure it's a policy question that's going to be on the forefront of many minds. In preparing this presentation, I kind of limited myself to what the Act does, not what it might do.
Remember, it's a statute, not a constitutional.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
We can change it.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. This is a policy issue that many agencies and I'm sure the legislature will be looking at for the reasons that you just described.
sort of like a prescription drug that goes goes non-prescription. Same deal. Yeah.
Okay. So we're dealing strictly with which is what is in the law says right now that was passed. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I just add that, you know, we're aware of many, many conversations going on about efficiencies potentially to be gained by some regulatory consolidation at every level along the way, from grow to retail. Now, that's not our job, but certainly as those proposals, ideas are looked at, we'll certainly work with you to make sense of them all. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Senator Beyer, then Senator Gerard.
Mr. Marks, I'll ask you. That third bullet point there, that's what the law says. But I guess you and your staff talked at all about what role OLCC may play in that, such as if we're going to. I remember Ms. Sweet was saying at the start that this is patterned after the OLCC law, with the exception of that.
I can actually speak to this. Senator Beyer, it is patterned very closely after existing law in Chapter 471. The distinction is that we regulate beer and wine very differently than we regulate distilled spirits. Mm-hmm. And this act is patterned after the way that we regulate beer and wine, which is a license model rather than a control model.
Okay, Senator
Jordan? Yeah, I need to go back a couple slides to the licenses, and it says there's no residency requirement. I'm just trying to figure out how we cannot have a residency requirement when we're one of the few states that this is going to be legal in. So are we saying that you can grow in Idaho? I don't understand, because, I mean, these are licenses for producers, processors, wholesaler, and retail. How can there not be residency requirements?
Senator Gerard, specifically what this refers to is the residency of the license holder, not the license's physical location. So, for example, you would need to have a physical location in Oregon, but the license could be held by an out-of-state corporation.
For retail?
For any license, yes.
Well, how can you be a producer? To produce in Oregon, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So Senator Gerard, similar to the way that we go for alcohol, Anheuser-Busch is a St. Louis corporation with physical locations in Oregon.
Okay. Yeah. Can corporations have licenses?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. If you want to continue. Mm-hmm.
The last point, which we just spoke to, was that the OLCC may not possess nor distribute. Marijuana remains illegal under federal law. In August of 2013, the U.S. Department of Justice issued guidance to states that had legalized recreational marijuana. This guidance is often referred to in shorthand as the Cole Memo. The Cole Memo identifies 8 objectives. These are essentially the federal expectations to states as they were communicated last summer. Number 1 is preventing distribution of marijuana to minors. Number 2, preventing revenue from sale of marijuana from going to criminal enterprises, gangs, and cartels. Number 3, preventing the diversion of marijuana from where it is legal under state law to other states. Number 4, preventing state-authorized activity from being used as a cover for illegal activity. Number 5, preventing violence in the use of firearms in the cultivation and distribution. Number 6, preventing drug driving and other adverse public health consequences associated with marijuana use. Number 7, preventing the growing of marijuana on public lands. And number 8, preventing marijuana use on public property. It's also worth noting that the drafters of the act incorporated these 8 points into their purpose statement. The OLCC expects some policy debate around where businesses are sited. The act does not set forth any explicit siting requirements, but the OLCC may have authority to adopt rules on license locations. Also, local governments may not prohibit licenses in their jurisdiction except via general election, which I referred to earlier. However, local governments may adopt reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions to regulate the public nuisance aspects of the premises. Moving on, the Act gives OLCC authority to regulate or prohibit advertising. However, we will, of course, have to be mindful of First Amendment considerations when exercising this authority. Also, the OLCC may regulate packages and labels to prevent appeal to minors, and we may adopt standards and testing requirements for marijuana products.
This is that.
Go ahead, Senator Byer. My question is, tobacco, we regulate advertising. So why can't we regulate advertising, on marijuana?
Senator Girard, the answer is that we can. The Act gives us explicit authority to do so, perhaps in an exercise of caution. I put the caveat regarding the First Amendment in there. I believe that Washington and Colorado are currently in litigation over their advertising regulations. So it's an area where we do have authority, but also where we may have to be mindful of those considerations.
Senator Byer?
Go ahead.
Do you have another question?
No, it's all Gabar.
Senator Girard looks like he has another question. Did you have a follow-up? Or?
Oh, no, I'm just shaking my head.
just thinking. Okay.
This is a little more open than it.
Thank you.
Just thinking of a Zonka bar advertisement.
I was looking at that too.
Senator Girard, it is worth noting that in Colorado specifically, there were quite a few what you might call look-alike products, and most of those products have come off the market due to trademark infringement litigation, where Hershey's had sued makers of marijuana products that were using parody names, such as the one that was displayed on the slide.
I do have a follow-up. My concern is kids. Yeah. And, they're going to put chocolate. They're going to do everything they can to appeal to kids. It's the same way that the tobacco industry used to do things a long time ago. And so that's where I'm afraid the advertisement and the gimmicks are going to go. And that's why I really think the agency needs to be on top of that segment of it and hopefully ban some of those products that are really geared to kids. So that's my concern.
Thank you, Senator. And I think that's an excellent segue to the next slide. The Act does allow production of marijuana-infused products, including edible products such as cookies, candies, and brownies that contain marijuana. These products may not contain consistent dosage, at least not dosage information that is consistently understood by the consumer.
Might not.
And could take 1 to 2 hours to affect the user. The OLCC does have authority to adopt rules to ensure that these products are appropriately labeled and do not appeal to minors. And in the early stages, this has been an area of focus for staff in terms of doing research on what other jurisdictions have done and trying to think of ways that we can address this issue in our administrative rulemaking process.
Senator?
I guess a couple of questions. One, I was looking at your previous slide, which says OLCC may adopt standards and testing requirements in conjunction with the has authority to adopt rules to ensure products are appropriately labeled. Is that a pretty expansive grant of authority?
Co-Chair Byer, I believe that it is. We have authority over setting standards for the quality of products, for how much product may be purchased, and we also have authority over how the product may be advertised. So you take those together and apply them to edibles, for example, and we may have authority to set limits for potency. We will have authority to make sure that the packaging does not appeal to minors, and we'll have authority to make sure that the product itself does not appeal to minors.
Are edibles specifically allowed?
They are. The term edibles is not used in the act. They're referred to as marijuana-infused products.
I have one more question.
Senator.
Okay. If somebody had a bunch of cookies set out on a tray, how is someone to know if they're marijuana infused or not? And is that going to be something, an issue that you look out for? I just have some real concerns of that. I like brownies and I like cookies, and I would hate to think that in the staff lounge we could have brownies and cookies and they're laced with marijuana. Might help some people, but it might not help others.
Because I assume what a person does with their in their own kitchen is different than
a business
marijuana-infused products that are sold.
Yeah,
that's correct. Yeah. And Co-Chair Doherty and Senator Girard, you both raise excellent points. We have authority to control what happens with that product when it is sold to the consumer. So we have authority to make sure that it's in a specific packaging that identifies it as marijuana. Once the consumer takes it to their home, removes it from the packaging, and puts it on the plate, you may not be able to tell if that's a marijuana-infused product or not. And also, these are products that can be produced in the home for home use without a license, in addition to the products that would be coming through the license system.
Well, I think it should be a crime if someone gives a marijuana-laced cookie to someone that doesn't want a marijuana-laced cookie. So I think that if you're looking at something, I think that that's going to be part of how we're going to put this together, because it's the same as giving a drug at the bar scene or doing anything like that, where you're giving unknowingly to someone something that they don't want.
And Senator, that may already be a crime under existing law. That's not an area that I can speak to right now. But if somebody is unwittingly given a product, that may already be prohibited.
Okay.
We're looking to the future here. Thank you.
This is the toughest area to deal with.
Yeah, it is.
The OLCC has identified the following enforcement priorities. First, to ensure that licensed businesses are operating according to regulations and preventing access to minors. Second, to prevent product migration between the legal and black markets. And third, to support local law enforcement agencies in their efforts to prevent unlicensed production and distribution of marijuana. To that end, one important policy consideration is whether we will require a seed-to-sale inventory tracking system. Seed-to-sale is a term of art that has developed in this field, and it refers to inventory tracking software that is designed to ensure that taxes are collected and inventory does not migrate. The way that it works is every plant is tracked via a barcode or an RFID tag from its initial growth phase to the final consumer. It's designed to allow for automated audits, tax collection, and enforcement, and ease of efficiency and enforcement. Essentially, the idea is the product is tracked at every step as it goes through the chain of commerce. From the seed at the producer to the final sale to the consumer. And it's designed to make sure that product, which starts in the legal regulated market, stays in the legal regulated market.
Is that actually working in those states?
Senator Beyer, I can tell you that it's been implemented in those states. I think it may be premature to offer any opinion on how well it's working. Mm.
Hasn't been there long enough.
The Act requires OLCC to examine research and present a report to the legislature in 2017 on impaired driving and suggested changes to the vehicle code. The Act does not identify a specific limit for marijuana intoxication. What this refers to is we do not have an equivalent of 0.08 for marijuana intoxication. OLCC will partner with DOJ Criminal Investigation Division and Oregon State Police to actively track data related to traffic incidents and intoxication and facilitate research on this issue in order to produce the required report.
Have the other states been able to do anything with this?
The other states, Madam Co-Chair, the other states have done something with this, and they've done something that's a bit different. They did include a specific limit for marijuana intoxication. And I believe the limit is five, I can't tell you if it's micrograms or milligrams.
Mm-hmm. Animal?
Some grams.
But they did come up with a number. My understanding is that the drafters of the Oregon measure did not include a specific number because there's a lack of consensus on the validity of the scientific research around that number.
Well, there is existing statutes that address driving under the influence.
Yes, and that's correct, Senator Beyer, and those statutes remain unchanged. The only distinction between what Oregon and other states have done is that we have not included a specific empirical number that can be used to show intoxication.
I'm surprised the assignment for this responsibility went to OLCC rather than to the state police or the DOJ. Seems misallocation of resource.
Chair, we are coordinating with state police and Department of Justice on it and plan to work with them pretty conclusively on it.
Mr. Revol had a comment, and then Senator Director.
Senator Bark, there has been for a number of years a method of examining drivers under the influence who are under the influence of marijuana. That is was established about 20 years ago and is a technique that's still used. So whereas we do not have the information as far as the technical level, it is in operation and it is being used today.
Good to know.
Actually, he might be able to answer my question. Is it only a blood test, or is it inhaling? Is it blowing into a tube, or what?
Senator Gerard, no, it's not an inhaling. It's a static test. It's a eye test, mm-hmm. where they would use either a finger or a pencil or an ink pen to test eye movement in the participant.
Because I understand that police jurisdictions have trained officers that are trained in identification of
medical treatment. Correct.
That's
correct. Yes. And driving under the influence is still driving under the influence, mm-hmm. regardless of the level of the intoxicant.
Because you can get arrested now for driving under the influence of prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'm pretty sure that.
Because I think it's the idea of intoxication is intoxication. Whether it's liquor, whether it's.
Madam Co-Chair, that's correct. Okay. Driving under the influence is driving under the influence, period.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Fiscal estimates.
These were our initial fiscal estimates, which appeared in the voters' pamphlet. So I wanted to stress that we are currently evaluating the adequacy of these estimates, and we're working with the DAS CFO and Legislative Fiscal Office in order to do so. With that being said, here are the estimates. Fiscal year 2015 is $333,000. Fiscal year 2016 is $2.6 million, and the 2017-19 biennium is $6.7 million. These estimates represent a total addition of 28 new FTE to the agency. And it's also worth noting that the seed-to-sale tracking system described earlier would be a significant cost factor in these estimates, at least on the startup.
Senator Mayer.
Have you looked at, I know this is all based on the analysis on what the Act says.
Yeah.
Have you, at the staff level, looked at potential recommendations that may make for a better system? Like if we modeled it after the liquor system, it seems like the control factors would be a lot easier to implement. They have more control over pricing and more consistency, more control over product standards.
Chair, for the record, Steve Marks again. I want to remind you what I reminded you of at the beginning, right? We haven't had this program under us, so we haven't done deep analysis of any of our alternatives. We've taken on the face what we are asked to implement statutorily today. When we get a staff on board, we'll be able to look at further analysis of, you know, coming from our commission or from you, the legislature, in terms of how we might implement and might control the system.
Madam Chair, perhaps an ask, legislative ask, Mr. Marks and Commissioner. This is the law of the land now. At least this is clearly what the intent of the public is, which I interpreted the intent of the public as much more they think we ought to, it ought to be legal. The rest of this, I would guess that most people don't pay a heck of a lot of, didn't pay a lot of attention to. It would be helpful if the staff and the commission would take a look at this and said, given that's the general parameter, are there some things that you would recommend to the legislature as we set about trying to implement this? Given the direction that the public obviously wants it legal, is there a better way to do it that we can deal with things like concerns about getting in the hand of children, limiting the cost to doing that, controlling the criminal elements, those kinds of things that would be helpful? Keep in mind, this is a statute, and statutes can be changed.
Mr. Chair, if I may, we are anticipating having to go through that process. We are now looking to identify those things that we think are of a technical nature, those things that we believe we have to take to our commission that are of a policy nature, and those things that, you know, we will fully share with the legislature and your processes. I know you have a, I'll call it the bicameral committee that's going to be appointed. So we look forward to working with that.
And unlike a bicameral committee, I like that.
And unlike most of our interactions, right, usually pass a law, you're familiar with what you gave us, and we, you know, an agency has to go out and do it. In this case, the people have given us something, and we've got to work backwards with you to figure out exactly what parameters the legislature wants to put around.
You got this. 2 months.
Thank you.
For the bicameral committee to deal with.
I just want to add on these cost figures. You know, we initially did these for the ballot measure statement. We did more thinking, more work, more design towards thinking about how we'd implement the timeline and budgeting towards September time frame. We got to have a better idea about that. As we did actually advance before the election, a placeholder request with the emergency board so we could get funded, get an early start with staff, and provide and supply you with more information as the session comes. Arises. We do are looking at moving from the back end some of the funding that we had in up to the front end, and particularly are concerned about the timeline with implementing a seed to sale system, if that's something that the legislature agrees with, wants that accountability around the system, then we need to do some early planning so we can have for you a good option to be able to consider to fund within our budget. So we're working with LFO Fiscal. That process is going well. I'm very pleased with it. There's a lot of cooperation and concern that the resources are right to get this start in place, and so that we can work with you in a diligent and productive manner. Thanks.
You'll see that the revenue estimates here vary quite a bit, and I believe this is due to the underground nature of the economy. It makes it difficult to fix both the size of the market and predict the OLCC's market capture. But you'll see a range of estimates here. The Financial Estimates Committee gave a range of $17 million to $40 million of annual revenue. The Legislative Revenue Office gave a range of $17 million to $26 million. And Econ Northwest, which was a private consulting firm engaged by the petitioners, predicted $38 million in annual revenue. Distribution of marijuana revenue follows a similar model as distribution of liquor revenue, but it goes into a different formula. First, the marijuana program expenses are deducted. Then the distribution goes 40% to the Common School Fund, 20% to mental health, alcoholism, and drug services, 15% to state police, 10% to cities for law enforcement, 10% to counties for law enforcement, and 5% to OHA for alcohol and drug abuse prevention.
Yeah, the question I have, there's nothing to say that that distribution money can't go in one end of the budget and be taken out at the other end of the budget, is there? It's a sleight of hand approach, and this was one of the selling features of this policy, and there's nothing to say that there's going to be additional funds in any of these at the end of the day.
Senator Girard, if I understand your question, it is whether, for example, the additional common school funds from the marijuana revenues could be offset by a deduction in common school funds from other sources.
And, that's right.
The only answer I can give is that there is nothing in the measure that specifically addresses this point.
Maintenance of effort provision.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
OLCC intends to take a measured approach to implementation. We are planning an open and transparent public process. To that end, we intend to go on a statewide listening tour to hear from the public. Independent of that, we are planning outreach to local government and public safety partners. We intend to form work groups consisting of stakeholders and experts in order to identify policy issues and make recommendations to the commission. There will, of course, be formal rulemaking. The agency will monitor legislation during the 2015 session. We will coordinate with other states where marijuana has been legalized. And we will continue interagency collaboration with OHA, ODA, and other affected agencies. We've developed some web portals as well as a dedicated phone line for the public. This initial communication strategy has been working quite well for the agency. I know my phone has not been overrun, so I think it's working well for me. And this slide shows the webpage and the emails. The webpage will be continually updated as we roll out our public process.
Okay.
The immediate next steps are the December e-board request that Steve referred to. We'll be requesting funding for four positions to begin work immediately. The listening tour, which we described, would likely begin very early in 2015. And of course, we will continue our engagement with the legislature, perhaps through bicameral committees. Mm-hmm.
Senator Beyer.
What are the four positions for?
The four positions are an executive manager for the program is one position. There are two policy analysts as well as a public affairs office. And they're designed, public affairs officer, they're designed to really shape the policy and start building the program. We're essentially building an agency within an agency. And these are this is the advanced team, if you will, to get us started in at the start of this process.
I guess one suggestion, and maybe it's not possible, it would be more helpful if you started your listening tour like in December, so that you could have information for the legislature when it came into session in February?
Chair, I think we'd love to do that. I logistically don't believe it's going to be possible for us to get out there in early December. We won't have a staff on to do the planning. And to appreciate, and we're working with the problem, but right now we have no budget authority to work on this issue, clearly, right? We're protecting the liquor funds by creating the bifurcation here. So we're going to be establishing that program and having a staff in place to help us plan that. So we'd love to be ahead of the curve. In other circumstances, we might. But just because of the nature of both funding, the timing of the effective date of the act, and our logistics around that, I don't see a way for us to get from here to there until late December, and that's not going to be of great value. I think we're going to have to do it after the beginning of the year.
Think about it.
Questions? Comments? Senator Girard?
Yeah, the last slide here kind of brings up a point, and that would be the feds sees tons of marijuana, I think. Is there any way that we can buy from the feds? I mean, this is really going to pose some really strange questions.
Business with the feds.
I mean, I hate to see it go up in smoke. So let's
And then they begin.
And then they begin. That's true.
Co-chairs, Senator Girard, that's an option which we've not previously considered. I believe we would run into some problems there with the act as it's currently written, because the OLCC is prohibited from possessing any marijuana, and that would be, I think.
Well, I'm not asking you to seize it. The drug authority be the one that from the feds, so.
A lot of good information.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the presentation just because I think it shows the challenges that we have, and it's always nice to learn from other states and what they've gone through, and hopefully you'll glean some of their experience. But when all is said and done, it's going to be what deals with the Oregon legislation or the measure and how that needs to be implemented, hopefully for the safety of as many Oregonians as possible.
Maybe this will become part of our rural economic development policy. Or maybe it already is.
So anyway, any other questions, comments? Okay, do we have a meeting in December?
We do.
That's what we were planning to ask. So we will look for a date for a public hearing.
Okay.
On all topics related to what the task force has discussed. Did you have a target date that you'd like us to look at for that?
During legislative days?
It would be nice during legislative days if we could
if
do
we
that.
Could do it then.
We'll see if that's a possibility. Yeah. May not be.
One way or another, we've promised that we would have that session, so we should do that. It probably would be better if we can do it around legislative days.
In legislative days, and it may be an after 5 p.m.
Sure.
I don't know if
that's probably more workable. We'll check with legislative leadership to see if what their thoughts are on when they'd like us to do that
but
as well.
But at least that time we're down here anyway.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Anything else for the good of the order?
Just a comment. I thought the staff work was excellent on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Across the board, the whole time we've been doing this has been very helpful.
Okay, and I do like the bicameral committees. That is very good.
Happy to be helpful.
Trying to avoid the other normal
Thank
nomenclature.
You.
Yes. Okay, on that, I will adjourn the Joint Interim Task Force on the OLCC. Thank you very much. On the OLCC. Thank you very much. Of course,